In the desert oasis where stories ignite, Skip's little bar, a beacon of light. From the Coachella Valley stars to cool everyday Joes, join Patrick and Randy, let the stories flow. At Big Conversations Little Bar, the magic spreads near and far. Backed by the McCallum Theater's grace, celebrate the voices that shape this place.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar at the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence, presented by the McCallum Theater. Visit McCallumTheater.org or reach the box office at 760-340-2787. Gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Howard. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar in the heart of Palm Desert, and we are at the coveted corner booth. My name is Patrick Evans, and I am alongside my dear friend, the great raconteur, the bon vivant, and sometimes occasionally the ne'er-do-well, Randy Florence.
Once again, a bunch of stuff I don't understand.
Oh, you understood all of that.
But you were smiling when you said it. So.
You wrote it all down and told me to read it. So, hey, good to see you.
Good to see you.
I am holding in my hand the McCallum Theater catalog for the upcoming season, the 25-26 season.
Incredible season.
Unless I misread this, and it's the 25-26, the year 25-26.
Oh, you know, we do have to come back in.
That's a long way away.
475 years.
No, a long time, but some of us will still be around. No, they've got a great lineup. I mean, Itzhak Perlman's on the cover. You've got Pink Martini, Storm Large is coming. John Lovitz.
Yeah.
One of
I've
my
seen
favorites.
Him live.
The Righteous Brothers. One of the originals is still with us.
One of them.
Yeah. So, and we got the Vienna Choir Boys.
Barry's back.
Barry Manilow.
Yeah. He's got a show.
Does he?
Yes.
What's he going to be doing?
I assume singing a little bit.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
We love Barry.
He
Manilow.
Does do balloon animals now, too.
I love his balloon animal. It's the best part of the show.
Christmas show.
He's doing his Christmas show.
Oh, that's right.
And it's the Barry Manilow Gift of Love, where he donates to multiple charities. I think they've selected 25 charities.
Right.
They've got the Canadian Brass. They don't give anything to charity. That's just...
But we like the Canadians.
They're upset about the tariffs.
Yeah.
As well they should.
They were going to give more. They just can't afford it now.
They can't afford it. We've tariffed them right out of it. Also, I encourage everybody to see this. You're going to have a couple of chances to do this. Jim Caruso's Cast Party featuring Billy Stritch on the piano.
Yeah.
Billy's amazing. I absolutely adore Billy and Jim Caruso. They bring in some terrific guest singers, and it's like you're at a cabaret in New York. You're like at Birdland. They're doing it in February, and I think they're doing it again in May.
Well, you were nice enough to take me one of those cast parties once, and that was amazing.
Well, we're angling to get Billy and Jim on the podcast at some point.
Right.
Billy likes to come out and perform solo. He loves Palm Springs. And he brings Jim Caruso out and they do cast parties. So, be sure. Log on to the McCallumTheater.org. The new season is up. Get your tickets before they are all gone. All the best shows go quickly. Randy has hogged up a whole bunch. You're right there. You get like, it's usually Barry Manilow, Gary Keefe, Randy Florence, and then Harold Matzner. That's the lineup of the front row.
Sounds about right.
So, you can't get really good seats because Randy bought them all. I'm delighted to introduce our guest today. I'm really super excited to have Frank Farina with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you and I have known each other since I moved to the desert.
Well, when I met you, this was me.
Wow. I don't remember you looking like that, Frank.
I don't either. But I was. Yes.
Well, I'm really looking forward to diving in because you've lived so many wonderful lives. We're going to explore all of them.
Oh, I was very, not all, but as many as we can. I was very fortunate. I think about that all the time. I just kind of stumbled into a great, great career, great life.
We first met when you were running your advertising company here in the desert.
With Scott Kiner.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Ralph Kiner's son.
Ralph's son. Yeah.
So back to baseball.
Yeah. Back to baseball.
I know you two want to duke it out.
I'm happy. Yeah. Duke Snider.
My man. He was my favorite Dodger.
But I wanted you to come on. Frank and I, we get together every once in a while for lunch. And Frank has the most marvelous stories because you had this incredible... You know, you move to the desert, you kind of meet people in the desert, and you don't know their backstory. And so I got to know your backstory just over the years of knowing one another. And, you know, so you move here, and I think, okay, well, Frank's been an advertising guy. He's an advertising guy. He's probably been out here for a million years. No, that is not true. Frank came from Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York.
And what was it that you wanted to be?
I wanted to be Perry Mason. I wanted to be an attorney.
Really?
Yes.
More than you wanted to be Duke Snyder.
Well, I knew I couldn't be Duke because I had no strength anywhere in my body.
That probably wasn't going to work.
But I could stand up and BS for any length of time, so I thought. But I did. I wanted to be an attorney, and I was going to pre-law school when I got out of high school. And my best friend in high school had gone right out of high school and went to work for ABC in New York. And that first summer, I didn't want my parents to pay my way through school, so I wanted a summer job. And he got me a job as a mailboy at ABC in New York. And I'm delivering mail to them. And ABC in those days was not NBC or CBS. NBC had Rockefeller Plaza.
Yeah.
ABC had offices spread out all over Manhattan because
they were the new kid on the block.
They were the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
And so the newsroom, the news office was in a building on West 66th. And I was delivering mail there one day, got on the elevator, door open, and I step on the elevator. And they had a speaker in the elevator that played background music as you were riding up the elevator. And there were three or four other people on the elevator, one of whom was Ted Koppel, who had just started at ABC. The other was Peter Jennings.
Wow.
Elevator goes up. As we get to the sixth floor, just before we stop, the music stops. And a newsman, ABC newsman, says, "We interrupt this broadcast for a special bulletin. Shots have been fired into the presidential motorcade in downtown Dallas, Texas."
And you're all in the elevator listening.
All in the elevator listening. The door's open. Jennings gets off. Koppel gets off. I get off. And I watched the newsroom fire into action. And I was hooked.
How old were you at that time?
I was 19.
Wow.
And forget law school, forget college. I was with ABC for 10 years.
It got in it just into your blood and under your skin. Well, in that newsroom environment, it's...
You couldn't help it. You couldn't help. You just watched these people do their thing. No sleep. No, nobody left. It was 24 hours.
You stayed there. You were there for a couple of days, weren't you?
Oh, I was there for 3 days.
Yeah.
And brought them their food, brought them their refreshments and things. And then ironically, some years later, I am now out in California, and I'm in Los Angeles, and I am there when Bobby Kennedy gets shot. And I'm thinking, maybe it's me.
Yeah. Now I feel like...
If your name's Kennedy, stay away from Frank.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to hang out with Frank.
No. But careful.
Yes. Now, you got sucked into that newsroom environment on one of the biggest news days of century.
That's a pretty high bar.
Yeah. That's like, is it always like this around here, guys? Right. No, probably not always. But you were the mail guy.
I was.
But you worked your way up pretty quickly. Talk about what your ascendancy in ABC, because you started out as the mail guy, but then they came to you and said, hey.
Well, I started out as the mail guy, but I had taken typing classes in high school. Of course, there were no computers and everything was all. And so I got, quote unquote, promoted from the mail room to a clerical job at ABC Radio. Because I could type.
Yeah.
And one day, I'm sitting there doing that, and the man for whom I worked, who ran the radio network at the time, one of the greatest people, Kent Coughlin was his name, he's long gone, calls me in his office, and Frank, sit down. He asks you a question, and I'm thinking, he's going to fire me. I did something wrong, because I'm Italian, and I did.
You just assumed you did something wrong.
I'm a Capricorn.
You know? We've got the Catholic glass, guilt.
The glass is always half empty. He says, let me ask you a question. Would you like to go to California? Now, I'm a kid in Brooklyn. living with my parents.
Had you ever been out of New York? Never,
to Jersey.
Jersey.
That's it.
That was it. The big trip.
Big trip was Jersey. And I said, I was tongue-tied. To do what? To live and work. What? ABC was expanding. They had no operation in Los Angeles at that time. And they wanted some New York people that they trusted to be out here that they could...
Was there a feeling that the East Coast was superior to the West Coast?
God, yes.
The news and
stuff
like that?
Absolutely. It was all East Coast.
Yeah.
It was all New York.
There's still that feeling.
Is there?
Oh, I'm sure.
God, yes.
Oh,
yeah.
That's why they never return my calls.
The network level, they definitely...
Yeah.
So and have you ever met a New Yorker who said, wow, L.A. is so much better than New York? No one's ever going to say it.
No.
So all of a sudden, you're not only kicked upstairs, but you have to fly out west and
open,
establish the operations.
Yes. I get on an airplane. I get on the first ever airplane.
You didn't fly to Jersey?
No. No, not, and won't anymore.
I don't blame you.
I got on the first airplane I'd ever been on. I was literally on my 22nd birthday and flew from New York to Los Angeles. Knew nobody, knew nothing. And I'm now here, or in Los Angeles, to start a new life. And
alone.
Alone, totally alone. And so I go to ABC, and I start befriending the announcers at ABC, and one of whom, and I think maybe I have, a picture. One of the announcers was one of the most interesting people I had ever met. Here he is. Thank you. Very good. This man, whose real name...
It's good radio.
His real name.
We are showing a picture to the camera.
His real name
first
was
time
Ralph.
On the podcast.
That is the first time. You
Well, you'd have enjoyed meeting this guy. His real name was Ralph Torres. He was Mexican, but his stage name, his working name, was Ralph James. He looked like Jackie Gleason when he didn't have the beard, and he sounded exactly like James Mason.
Wow.
He was a fascinating character.
And he took you under his wing.
Oh, yes. Now I forget how much I've told you. He took me under his wing, and one day, and he couldn't remember anybody's name, so he called everybody Dad. Dad, I'm going to take a ride. And we go from ABC, which was on La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles, and we drive to downtown Los Angeles, and he pulls up to this, what I thought was a movie theater, and it turned out to be a burlesque house. And on the billboard outside...
Hi, Frank.
No, I wish. It says, now appearing, Terry Taylor. And literally, it said, Terry Taylor, and under her name, the girl with the 50-inch bust. I will never forget that.
And that would leave an impression. That would leave an impression.
Well, to cut...
More ways than one.
To cut a long story short, Terry Taylor... whose real name was Frida Tinnabell. Frida Tinnabell took my virginity.
Wait, but I love the whole story, though. So Ralph knows her.
Oh, yeah. They had worked together in San Diego.
And so he takes you back to meet her.
Yes.
So you go backstage.
Yes.
And you get to meet the woman with the 50-inch bust.
Yes.
But one thing leads to another. Now, you are living a... big lifestyle as a single guy.
Oh, yeah.
Convertible
in LA.
Apartment in L.A.
Corvette convertible.
Corvette convertible. No, Frank was doing it right.
Oh,
when
yeah.
he came out to California, he was like...
A red Corvette convertible.
But you strike up a conversation with this young lady.
Oh, yes.
And what... But something happened.
Yes, yeah, something happened.
It usually does.
Yes, and it did. We got to talking, and we hit it off. And she said, can we go to dinner together? And we ended up going to have something to eat. And at the end of the dinner, I said, I didn't know where she lived. And she said, I don't live anywhere right now. Excuse me? She was living with a guy. They broke up. He took the apartment and literally threw her out. And so being the nice little Italian guy, and I said, well, you can come back if you'd like to stay at my place for the night.
I have the room for the four of us.
And so that began a while for a kid from Brooklyn.
Now, you're early 20s at this point?
I was 22.
Now, how long did she take up residence at your apartment?
Not that long. She was, she was there. She was there maybe a week to 10 days, and she got her own apartment. But by that time, she had taken my virginity, which was unreal.
I'm assuming you weren't her first.
No, God, you can assume
so
that.
Did she know?
That was, I thought, a gracious gesture for Frank to put her up for a couple nights.
That's
I mean,
right.
That seems...
Yeah. I think a lot of relationships have begun like that.
Why was Italian?
Did she know that you were a virgin?
She did, because I... foolishly was at one point, God, some of it is locked in my brain. I didn't know where you began, and can we talk like this?
We can talk. We can say anything we like.
Yeah.
What talk like no one's listening, because generally they're not.
And dance like nobody's watching.
That's right.
What she taught me first was oral sex. And it went from there. And it was just, I had never in my life experienced anything remote. I mean, I had dated, you know, in high school. But this was an
opening.
Did
you call home and tell your parents you'd found
oh,
a girl?
Sure. Oh, sure.
So let's go back a little bit. Yeah. What was home life like growing up? Was it a very open family? Was it?
I come from a huge Italian family.
That's kind of redundant.
Yes, it is.
I come from a huge family as well.
Yeah.
I just have one sister, but she's fat. Go ahead, Frank. Sorry.
I can't top that. There's no way I can top that. My mother was one of seven children. My father was one of six. I had dozens of cousins. We all, if this was Brooklyn, this table, we all lived here in this corner in apartments, and we were together all the time. Holidays was just food, unreal. And so when I first came to California, I knew nobody, and it was like somebody had just said, here, you're here. And it took a while for me to get myself, you know.
So was there one of the cousins that was the first one to hear your story about meeting this woman?
No.
No?
No. In fact, none of my cousins have ever heard the story.
No.
About me meeting. No.
They're probably big listeners to the podcast. So.
We have a big Italian audience on the East Coast. So, I mean, Ralph was a bit of a mentor to you.
Oh.
But, man, what a favor he did for you, introducing you to this young lady.
He
went on. He was basically a staff announcer at ABC. He had movie roles.
Oh yeah, he was a character actor.
I'm interested. Back then, did he have to change away from a Hispanic last name in order to work?
Well, I don't know, because when I met him, he was already being his name is, as far as I knew, was Ralph James.
Okay,
that's all I knew. It wasn't until we became friends that the Ralph James Torres came up and came out. So probably, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case.
Look, I went on television in the 80s, and I had to change my last name.
Really?
Yeah. Evans, I don't think this is a great shock, but Evans is my stage name. It's my middle name. It's real. It's my mother's maiden name.
Yeah.
But Iachetta is my last name.
What?
But, yeah. Iachetta. And that's exactly.
110 episodes.
When I went to work, now I worked in my hometown of Charlottesville, and of course everybody knew my last name. I grew up there. But when I went and moved to Roanoke, Virginia, the news director politely but strongly insinuated that maybe a simpler name would be easier to catch on.
Yeah, well, it's smart.
I mean, which is true. Although I wish now I'd gone with something. I would have gone with Escobar if I'd known I was going to live out in California.
Pablo.
Well, and one, you know, my actual name on my birth certificate is Francesco Felipe Vincenzo Fiorino.
Wow.
Frank Philip Vincent Fiorino. And so when I first came out, I thought, when I went to work for Dick Clark, I decided to drop the name Fiorino. And for a great while, I went by Frank Vincent.
Oh.
and I used the name Frank Vincent. And my father got a little upset.
He didn't like that.
Yeah.
My father was always upset that I didn't use the family last name.
What did your dad think about the career you had moved into?
Actually, he was... You remember... what was his name? There was an actor. It'll come to me. Cesar Romero. Do you remember the actor?
Oh, yeah.
He played the Joker on Ben-S.
Yeah. My father, literally, I am not exaggerating, was Cesar Romero's twin brother.
Wow.
He looked exactly like... And whenever we had a problem in school, the teachers would say, have your father come up and talk to the female
They wanted
teachers.
To see him.
Oh, yeah. He was drop dead. But he never, ever played it. He was quiet. He was faithful to my mother. In fact, he was a little taken aback because, and it kept him out of the war, he stuttered rather seriously. And so he was embarrassed to get involved socially.
What kind of work did your dad do?
Well, it's interesting. Before computers, everything was paper. He worked just off Wall Street for a printing company that did all of the printing for Wall Street brokerage houses. That was my first job. One summer, I went and worked for him. He ran the packing department in that company.
Oh, wow.
And I went there and worked for him one summer, and I became a proofreader one summer, because in those days, you had two guys sitting side by side. And I read to you, and you read to me.
That stood you in good stead for your later career.
For my later career. Oh, absolutely. And he and my mother were two of the most. I brought them out here. They retired. They were going to move to Florida. I said, no. You're coming this way. And I brought them to Palm Springs, and they retired in Palm Springs. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. So now, I was very fortunate.
How long did you stay at ABC? You said you were there for 10 years, so...
I was at ABC for 10 years.
What was your next move?
I went from... I went from ABC...
He spent a lot of time in strip clubs.
Yeah, well, I don't blame him. I mean, the first visit worked out really well. When you hit the jackpot, you go back to the casino a couple of times.
The second one, you're like, hello, I'm here.
Yeah, hey, ladies. before we get to that, you stayed in that ABC office, the Los Angeles office. That was your gig for those 10 years.
Yes.
And I think you were working at ABC when you told this story. But you ran across a great many people who were ABC stars, one of whom, Howard Cosell.
The great Howard Cosell. Oh, yeah. I worked with Howard. What story? Did I tell you a story about Howard?
Yes, you did. You picked him up and you had to take him to a meeting, and he was meeting Mickey Rooney.
Oh, Mickey Rooney. That's right.
Howard Cosell Mickey Rooney. This is one of the great stories of all time.
I picked him up at the airport. He was coming from New York, and I drove him to MGM. And Howard was a very tall, you look like a tall man. He was a tall guy. And we get to the studio, and... I forget what they were filming, but they were on a break. And in the corner, there were about six guys, one of whom was Mickey Rooney. And Mickey Rooney was
a little bit smaller than Howard.
Yes. And Cosell walked up, and Mickey's back was to us.
Mickey was like holding court there.
He was holding court with the other six guys. And Cosell walked up, got up behind him, and tapped him on his head and said, Mick. You gallant little warrior, you.
Oh, my God. Look at that little monkey run.
You gallant little warrior. I just love that.
Oh, yeah.
Cosell was Mickey's? Because Mickey had a little bit of a short temper. What was his response?
No. He was totally taken.
He was okay with it.
Oh, yeah. They were evidently, they developed some kind of a friendship.
But you crossed paths with a lot of people like Howard Cosell.
Oh, yeah. Well, my favorite sportscaster in those days was Keith Jackson.
Keith Jackson.
My son is named after Keith.
Wow.
Keith and I became very close.
I miss him calling college football so much.
Oh, yeah. He was a mentor. Keith was a mentor. He, on mic and off, he was just good people. I was very fortunate. I mean, between the Cosells and the Keith Jacksons, Barbara Walters, come on, Farina, Ted Koppel, Peter Jennings. I was fortunate. I just stumbled, and I thought stumbled into it. I didn't go with any plan. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that. I just showed up.
But by this time, you were pretty much figuring I'm not going into law.
Well, yeah. You got that, did you? Yeah. Yeah, and every once in a while, I'll think back. What if? You know, what if? But I have no complaints. I had a great...
Did you ever meet Raymond Burr, who played...
No, I did not get to meet Raymond Burr.
Damn it. That would have been,
that would have been really cool.
That would have been... So you leave ABC, and what was the next... I mean, we're just touching the iceberg. Frank has done so many different things. They're all really cool. And it drives me nuts because, you know, he can barely carve out one career. This guy's had a dozen. Well, so you decide to leave ABC.
I'll tell you, this lady.
Rita
Lakin.
Rita Lakin. Your Honor, may the record reflect.
Yes, we're looking at Rita Lakin.
Rita Lakin, who's no longer with us, was the first female television producer in network TV. She was an incredible lady, and she changed my life because she was producing a series called, it'll come to me. But it starred, you remember the sportscast of Tom Harmon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was an ex-college football player. Yeah.
And his son is Mark Harmon.
Well, that's right. And that's the reason I met her, because Mark Harmon was starring in a new TV series she was producing. And I had heard that it was starring Mark Harmon, and I thought, I'm going to go see him, just because I worked with his father. And so one day, I went to Paramount Studios. I went to the studio, and I worked my way onto the set, and they were on a break. And I got to meet her. She introduced her. And I said something. I watched them shoot a scene, and I got a sense of what the show was about. And I won't remember specifically the conversation, but at one point, she said, "What do you think?" I said, "Oh, it's very nice." I said, "You thought about what if? What if you had that character do this and do that?" And she looked at me and said, "Write it." Oh, I said, I'm not a writer. She said, "If you write it, you're a writer. Write it and let's see what happens." She gave me a copy of the script to follow the format. And I went home and I wrote an episode of that show. What the hell was the name? And they bought it. And the next thing you know, I'm in the Writers Guild, and I'm writing television.
So we're going to talk about more specifically, but some of the shows that you wrote for that came as a result of that meeting.
Shows of that era. You remember shows like General Hospital?
Yep.
Dynasty.
Remember them well.
Dallas.
Yeah. My wife and I were one of the couples sitting there wondering who shot JR.
There you go.
All right, we are going to take a quick break and acknowledge our presenting sponsor, the McCallum Theater. The new catalog for the new season has just dropped. Now is the time to get those tickets. McCallumTheater.org. Let's hear from our friends at the McCallum.
At the McCallum Theater, we believe in placing arts at the heart of learning. Since 97, our education department has inspired nearly 1 million students and community members through dynamic performances and immersive arts education programs. From the Palm Desert Choreography Festival to our Open Call Talent Project, we provide powerful platforms for emerging artists. Experience how the arts contribute to personal growth and enlightened citizenship. Your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater. Learn more at McCallumTheater.org.
And we are back with our guest, Frank Farino. I almost said my guest.
Yeah, I noticed.
Like you weren't here. And yet you are.
I'm going to go get a burger.
And yet you are. Sorry. Of course. You know, we would not be this
podcast.
I've
been married 44 years. If I haven't learned how to deal with stuff like that.
Does your wife do that to you?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot? Enough.
Not as much as you do.
Enough. So you hammered out a script.
Yes.
And they actually bought it. I mean, this is back in the day where one could do that sort of thing. I think it's a lot harder now.
Yeah.
But and they don't even make scripted television anymore. It's all, you know. But
it's all AI.
Yes, right. So, I mean, all of a sudden, you're swept up going in a completely different direction. You've been working for ABC News.
Yeah.
Which, and now you're in the entertainment world and you're writing.
Well, just before that happened, there was a little break. Do you remember the name? Does the name Joe Pine mean anything to you?
No, that doesn't sound familiar to me.
Joe Pine, who's no longer with us, in his day, was one of the first talk show, but you know, one of those angry talk show guys who was there to give you grief. And he was building a reputation for himself and climbing the ladder. And I, as a freelancer, I got to direct some of his shows. And he wanted, and I was still working at ABC, but freelancing with Joe. And he came to me one day and said, why don't you leave and come full time and work with me? And I didn't know what to do. So I went to a man who had become a mentor to me. There was a man whose name won't mean anything to you. He was the, his name was Bob Masson, Robert Masson. And he had been the producer of, you remember a show called the Colgate Comedy Hour?
Yeah.
He had been a television producer. He had produced a number of shows. But he had left television, and when I met him, he was vice president of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company.
Oh, my goodness.
And when Joe Pine offered me this chance to go in, I didn't know what to do, and I went to Bob as a kind of a mentor, and he said, you don't want to do that. He said, you want to stay with the network. Always stay with the network. Which turned out, for all the wrong reasons, to be absolutely the thing to do, because very shortly after that, had I left and gone to work with Joe Pine, 3 months later, he died. Suddenly and without warning, and that was that. But I stayed at ABC. And at ABC in those days was a man you may have heard of, Dick Clark.
Heard of Dick?
Yes.
You have a connection with we've had a couple of guests with connections to Dick Clark, but Fred Bronson.
Fred Bronson, yes.
Fred worked with Dick.
Oh, he did the New Year's Eve.
He did a bunch of stuff with him. He was his publicist for a while.
Yeah. Speaking of New Year's Eve, because of my connection to Dick, I got 1 year to go to the New Year's Rockin' Eve show at Times Square with Dick. The insanity was beyond.
Oh, I can only imagine.
No, you can't. But those years with Dick were just. I created, he allowed me to create a syndicated radio network for him. And I created a show called Dick Clark's Good Old Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
You know that?
Oh, yeah.
And we had that at one point on about 250 radio stations.
Wow.
And we were just cooking.
You were going to do a show with Robert Loggia. Was it Robert? No.
No.
Robert Langella.
Frank Langella.
Frank Langella.
Oh, yes.
Oh, we'd get there eventually.
Bruce Springfield.
Yes, yes.
Bruce Springfield and Bob Langella.
That's a callback,
Bob,
by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Frank Langella.
Frank Langella. We're still friends. We still love that.
You guys were going to do a radio show.
Radio show.
You had a concept.
Yes. He was doing.
He's got a great voice.
Oh, he's
that would
got
be
an
really
incredible
good.
Incredible voice.
Yeah.
I went to see him on stage in New York where he was playing Dracula. And I was dumbfounded by it. And I managed to arrange a meeting. In fact, Rita arranged the meeting for me, Rita Lakin. And we met and liked each other. And I thought, he's got the perfect voice for radio. And I created a show called Frank Langella's Midnight Odyssey. It was a nighttime music talk show with him as the host. And we did a pilot. We were starting to get radio stations on the NBC network. And an after strike hit and stopped it completely. Oh. Anyway, we never did get to do the radio show, but we became very close, and still are. I talk to him every great once in a while. He still lives in New York and watched his career. Hell of a guy. But she changed my life. We created a TV series together based on the fact that I got sick one day and had to go to the hospital overnight. And I was in the hospital.
You will remember this show when Frank tells you about it.
Okay.
We're in the hospital, and I watched from my bed overnight how the nurses basically were running the operation. And when I got out, I went to Rita, and I said, what do you think? And bottom line, we hooked up, and we created a TV series called Nightingales. And we were both working at that time for Aaron Spelling, writing Dynasty. I was producing Dynasty at the time. So by sheer necessity, we had to bring it to Aaron Spelling first. We brought it to him. He said, oh, yeah, I love this. We're going to do it. And we took it to NBC to pitch it to NBC. The problem was Aaron made all his money. If you remember the shows like Dynasty, it was all about very attractive women changing their outfits and showing you their bodies. And it was all very physical.
Kind of how you started your career.
Well, yeah.
That was nothing about his career. It was just his buddy took him to meet a nice lady.
I would be telling that as the moment my career got started. But I went into entertainment.
Exactly. But Aaron, all he saw in the show about nurses was the nurses coming to the hospital and changing out of their street clothes into their uniforms. That's all he wanted to see.
And you really wanted to do a serious drama about how the nurses...
About how they ran the operation behind the scenes. And without them, the doctors would have been in very big trouble. And so he got a meeting at NBC. We went to NBC. We pitched it. They bought it. And we started putting it together, but again, all he wanted to see were the naked ladies changing.
So it was like a medical version of Baywatch.
Exactly. And unfortunately, at that time, everything was changing. Females were coming into their own, and the actresses were coming into their own. And so the backfire was very big.
Yeah.
I don't have it with me, but in my office, I still have it framed. The first week the show premiered, it premiered at number one. Nightingales, number one. Okay. From that point, the minute everybody realized what it was, it went down, 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 down. We were off the air in something like 4 weeks, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it never lasted a season. And that was that. And sad, but, you know, it was my shot.
So I read...
Well, you premiered at number one. You have that.
That's I had the number one show.
You wrote for so many great shows. I mean, you were writing for Dynasty at the time.
I wrote for Dynasty. I wrote for Dallas. I wrote for... I won't remember half the shows.
Did you write for Knott's Landing?
I wrote for Knott's. I did, yeah. I wrote for... Oh, my God, yeah. And I was... I thought I had died and gone to heaven.
Which of those... I mean, I guess it's all sort of a job. Like, you have a writer's room, you go in, you're pitching scripts, which was the most fun? I mean, it seems like, just on the outside, I think Dallas seems like a lot of fun.
Dallas was a lot of fun. Dynasty, with the ladies in Dynasty, was a lot of fun. But it was changing.
I saw an interview where you said that at that point in the industry, there was a real separation between the writers and the actors.
Oh, absolutely.
And the interview was asking how involved you were in talking to the actors, and you were like, not at all.
You never did. You never got to see them. You dealt with the producers, and the producers dealt with the actors. You know, they wanted you behind the scenes, and that was that.
So you never got to go on set?
Were not allowed on set.
Not allowed.
Now, isn't that crazy?
You could sneak on set.
Yeah. Right.
We did, but you were not allowed on set. It was a different ballgame. It was a totally different ballgame. But... Again, I say, I hate to be repetitive, but as a kid from Brooklyn, it's like, look at me. Look at what I'm doing.
You know, you ask this of many of our guests. Is there a point where you're just sitting there thinking, wow.
I can't believe this is my life.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, that to me was, look what I'm doing, and how did I get here? And she did. She changed my life.
Well, what a remarkable, I mean, I just find that so incredible that... First of all, she would just casually ask you, hey, what did you think of that?
Yeah.
And then after listening, you say, hey,
write
there's an idea. Write it.
Yeah.
You know, that's so open, and a lot of people just wouldn't, in Hollywood today, they wouldn't.
No. No. No, we connected. We became best friends almost instantly, and she was my mentor. She was my absolute mentor.
Now, when did you go to work for Dick Clark?
I went to work for Dick Clark before she and I met. I came to Dick Clark. Years won't come to me, but it was before I started writing for television. I was not a writer. I was in radio. I came out of ABC Radio, and I had met him because he was an ABC personality.
Right.
And I went to his office one day. He had an office in Burbank at the time. And I just had a conversation, and I said, why aren't you hosting a radio show? Because he was doing a lot of television. And that comment opened a door. And the next thing I know, I'm writing and producing Dick Clark's Good Old Rock and Roll on 200-some radio stations.
I want to get back to Linda Evans.
We hadn't gotten to Linda Evans
yet. I've been there for about 20 minutes. Some iconic episodes for both Dynasty and Dallas during that time. Ones that people still talk about today. Yeah. Did you have anything to do with writing the Who Shot JR episode?
No. I was there when it was being put together, but I can't. I'd like to say that I should say that I wrote it.
You did. I remember when you wrote that.
We're never going to meet any of the other writers.
Who's going to dispute you?
How about the Bobby in the shower scene?
No, I didn't do the Bobby in the shower scene. Or maybe I did, and I don't remember that I did it. That's very possible.
How about the wrestling match between Joan Collins and Linda Evans?
No, I did not do that. I did not do
and
that.
And you didn't even get to watch it.
Exactly. I loved Linda Evans. Yeah. I just absolutely adored her. Yeah, as I say, for a kid from Brooklyn, it just, you know, the doors opened and it was unreal.
How many of those, that big family that you grew up with, how many of those people started coming out to watch what you were doing? Any of them?
None of them.
No? Did they care?
It wasn't that they didn't care. They were all Brooklyn Italians and lived, you know, it was all this.
Did they kind of look down at Hollywood people a little bit?
Well, kind of, you know. But I'd go back to New York for holidays.
I'll bet you were a celebrated prodigal son.
Oh, absolutely. Thanksgiving was one of the great, and in fact, funny story.
They're all asking him, did you write the episode with the JR?
You are talking, gentlemen, to the producer of the first ever country music concert at Carnegie Hall.
With you?
Who? Me.
Who, really?
Who was the performer?
You don't seem to have a background in country music, Frank.
Oh, I did. I spent a lot of time in country music, and I produced...
Really?
Yeah. I produced the first country music concert, and it was the Oak Ridge Boys at Carnegie Hall. And I can see it now. It was not a full house, but a packed house. And you talk about my family... I had invited my mother and father and my godmother, my aunt. We used to call her Darling Lily. She wanted to be in show business so badly. And she's sitting right down front, about three rows back. And before the concert started, they asked me to go out on stage and address the audience and let them know that this was a first. It's the first country music at Carnegie Hall. And so I come out and I love, you know, center of attention, and I'm out there. And I start my little spiel. And I tell you, I called her Darling Lily. And within 2 minutes of my spiel, Darling Lily jumps up out of her seat. I'm his aunt.
Oh, my gosh.
That's hilarious. So true story. She was something else. Yeah, I was very fortunate.
How did you get involved in country? I mean, you're a kid from Brooklyn.
I got involved. Yeah, it's a good question. How did I get involved in country music? Who did I meet? I met someone. Whew. It's been
We ask the tough questions on this podcast. Oh,
yeah. They are tough questions because it's been
I keep hoping every answer is going to be, I was in this strip club. And
there's some precedent for that.
There is. Hey, I mean, if you've had luck with something like that, keep it going.
Oh, yeah. I'll agree to that. I don't remember specifically how I got involved. What I did also get involved in, we haven't talked about. Did I ask you, there's the name, maybe I did ask you, if the name Joe Pine meant?
Yeah, we talked about Joe Pine.
Joe, yeah, because I got involved in talk radio and talk TV. I had a varied career. I mean, I just, you know, I had no plan. I had no, I'm going to do this, which is going to lead me to that, and then that'll lead me to here. I just kind of showed up. And wherever I showed up, I was fortunate enough to be able to do.
Were you in front of the camera?
No, I
no.
never. No, I
did
never.
You,
you did
be?
A lot of voice work, though.
I did voice work. I did voice work in movies. I'm in Apollo 13.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't
you
know,
didn't know that.
That.
I did not know
that's
that.
Really cool.
It's one of my favorite movies.
Me too.
I said I'm in. My voice is in Apollo 13. I met Tom Hanks. And I got to, he opened some doors, and so I did some voiceover.
So what was your, give us the Apollo 13.
I was, oh my God, I was one of the technicians at NASA. I was a voice.
Inside Mission Control.
Inside Mission Control. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. And I did stuff like that without thinking twice about it, because it was just, I was having a good time. And to this day, did I bring one with me? I thought I did. I still get residual checks. You got to see this check. I've got this
I got to put this on camera.
I thought, oh my
Where do I
God,
go, John?
Look at this.
Here. There you go. $0.02.
A 2 cent.
They spent a full price on a stamp to send you a 2 cent check.
Well, I called them and I said, "Do me a favor."
So things must be going pretty good if you haven't had to cash this.
Oh yeah.
You've been sitting on that.
Yeah, I can afford that.
Saving it for a rainy day.
I did. I called and I said, "Do me a favor. The next time, save the check. Send me the stamp." This is silly. So I got a bunch of these. This is not the only one. I've got them for 35 cents, 25 cents, or anything.
What brought you to the Coachella Valley?
Oh,
as you changed careers yet again, the chameleon that you are.
That's right.
What brought me to the Coachella Valley?
And when was that?
Oh, my God. I've been here 25 years. And it was because of my parents. My parents were in New York with all of my family. I'm the only person ever come out. And my father was retiring, and they talked about moving to Florida. And I said, Florida? No, 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 no. You're coming west. And I got them an apartment in Palm Springs. And they came, and they thoroughly loved it. And because I loved them so dearly, I missed them every day.
Mm.
But I'd come out to Palm Springs every weekend to be with them.
Sure.
So you must have spent some time here before that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did spend some time here before that. And I met, you know this, I think, the man who became one of my great best friends, who owned one of the great establishments in Palm Springs, the Ingleside Inn.
Mel Haber.
And that kind of solidified my stay here.
That's a good friend to have in that town.
Yeah, yes. He was something else. I miss him every day. He was something else. And so I brought them out. I got them an apartment. And I was coming out here every weekend to be with them. And then as the technology, and I was still writing, but you had to be in the studio. The technology was advancing, and suddenly there were computers, and you didn't have to be on site at the time. And so...
And those typing skills from an early age came into handy,
aren't
didn't
you
they?
Glad you took that typing class?
Absolutely. Yeah. Without a joke, it was changed my life.
Yeah.
Rita Lakin and typewriting changed my life. And so...
Well, and then a stripper, but that's another story.
I came out, and one of the first people I met was a man I think you knew, Scott Kiner.
Yes.
And Scott and I hooked up, and we started a marketing company together, and that just changed everything. Excuse me.
When I moved to the Valley, you were... In the marketing world.
Yeah.
And doing a lot of voiceovers. You were the voice of Desert Oasis Healthcare for...
Oh, my God, yeah. Forgotten that.
Yeah. Many, many years.
Yeah. I was very fortunate. I had no plan. I had no agenda. I would just kind of show up, you know.
But you're still writing today. You wrote a terrific play about Marilyn Monroe.
You say that. And isn't that funny? There she is.
That is Marilyn Monroe.
That is Marilyn Monroe. Yes. That.
She's way better looking than you, Frank.
Yes, she is.
Even from this side.
Marilyn Madness and Me, the name of the play. Yeah. I've had you on Eye on the Desert talk about it. You produced this. But tell people kind of the thought process behind it when you first started writing this play.
Well, it was interesting because it would never have happened had my bride and I not gone to dinner one night at a Palm Desert restaurant. Do you remember Café des Beaux-Arts?
Sure. I was just there last week.
Okay. Well, at the time, it was owned by a Frenchman, Didier. Interesting character. And we were in there having dinner one night, and somehow somebody had told him that I was a producer. And he came to our table, brought us a glass of wine, and started talking. He says, I have this idea. Oh, somebody should do something with Marilyn. Marilyn who? Monroe, Marilyn Monroe. Do what? I don't know, but something should be done with her. And it just planted the thought here. And out of that came a play I wrote called Marilyn Madness and Me. And I wrote it specifically to be a one-woman show so that you didn't have to worry about doing a huge production.
Yeah.
And it was Marilyn. The only other character that you see for a brief moment on stage was her chauffeur. I drove her around. But other than that, it was Marilyn.
Had you ever met her?
No, I had never.
How did you write about Marilyn without knowing her?
I researched my brains out.
And there's no Google back then.
No, there was no books. I read a lot of books, and I read.
This wasn't that long ago when he wrote the play.
Yeah.
When did you write the play?
Oh my God! Now it's been about 20 years ago.
Barely Google.
There was Google.
There was Google.
Yeah.
There was Google.
No, but
it was Giggle.
I knew people who knew people who knew people who. And so I wrote it, and we. I found, and this was just before COVID, and I found some people who were interested in putting some money up who wanted to be in show business. And I was able to raise $75,000.
Wow.
And we did a production here in the desert, as a matter of fact.
And you had, was it Bonnie Gilgallon?
Oh my God.
Did
Bonnie
she play Marilyn?
She played Marilyn in the play, yeah.
I can see that.
Oh yeah, God, she was well cast for that part.
Yeah. And it went over very well. And we had a potential investor who said, are you interested in taking this east? Oh, well, we can talk.
But he meant Temecula.
East to Albuquerque or east to, how far east do we go?
right up the 60.
Well, what he was talking about was Chicago.
Wow.
But had it made it to Chicago, there was no question in my mind it would have made it to New York. But just as all this is happening, excuse me.
We'll edit it all out in post.
Voice is going to be much deeper.
Yeah, actually, George Clooney will be doing your voice.
That's right.
It's really great.
As we were putting it together, as we were talking about getting to Chicago, COVID hit, and it stopped everything. The money went away, and it just didn't come back. And we never did pursue it after that.
And you've been toying around. I know that you've visited a couple of times and never quite got off the ground, but I'm not sure you're done with it. But writing something about Ava Gardner.
Oh, my God, yes. I fell in love with Ava Gardner when I was 13.
Wow.
And, of course...
Was she aware of this or no?
I was afraid
to... No, but Frank was. That was the problem.
I was afraid to tell her because of Frank. But there are some great... Do you know the story when she was living here with Sinatra? There was Palm Springs, which is where they lived, and there was Indio, and there was nothing in between. Desert. It was just, you could drive down 111.
Two-lane road. No sign, no stop lights.
And she, on a Sunday, would get in their convertible. She would drive. They would head from Palm Springs toward Indio. and Frankie would be in the passenger seat, top down, with two cowboy six guns. Nobody to hit, nobody to hurt. And he was Frankie.
There's a famous part of that story. They got to Indio, and he actually did clip a guy.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
Went into a saloon in Indio and clipped a guy in the ear.
Ooh.
And he ended up, he paid the guy like 10 grand. And it...
Wow. I had not heard that. Now, you know, I told you my story with Sinatra.
Yes, and I want you to tell this. So you were at...
Frank shot you?
No. I was just witness.
It's a two-part story. So you were still at ABC.
ABC. It was the night Ronald Reagan was elected governor of California.
Okay. And you were in the Polo Lounge.
Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
frequent Sinatra hangout.
It was the end of the day.
And obviously a frequent Frank Farino.
Well, no, it was not. But because it was Ronald Reagan becoming governor of California, it drew a lot of interest in the thing. And a bunch of reporters from ABC came out from New York to cover it. And it was all done. And somebody said, we need to go to a quiet place for a drink. Frank, you live here. Where? I said, it's nothing quieter than the Polo Lounge. And okay, we go to the Polo Lounge. We're sitting. I believe there were three or four of the reporters and me. And I'm the kid. I was the youngest guy there. Sitting in a booth, literally right here, was Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., who was
Peter Lawford.
Peter Lawford, thank you. And a female. And I don't know who the female was, but there were five of them sitting in this booth. And they were doing their thing. Sitting just about 5 feet from them and us was a table of two very quiet business gentlemen in business suits chit-chatting with each other, having dinner. And at one point, Sinatra, and I didn't realize it until he got up and walked over to their table. He had a drink in his hand, and he said something to one of the two men. We couldn't hear what Sinatra said, but the guy looked up and said, well, and you could hear this very clearly, well, Mr. Sinatra, that's not really true. Your table is making a lot of noise.
Ooh. Yep.
And Sinatra, at that point, pulled him out of the chair, decked him to the ground right here. I mean, we're sitting 3 feet away. This is all happening right in front of us. Sammy Davis Jr., Frank, for Christ's sake, he comes running over to Sinatra. At that point, the maitre d' had called for the waiter, get me some water. They brought some water. The waiter comes over with a little jug of water. Sinatra sees the waiter with the water, takes the jug and throws it at the guy on the floor.
Jesus.
And Sammy said, Frank. And they get him out. They leave. One of the reporters who I'm with said, we better get out of here quickly. We get out. We go to get the cars. We're in front of the Beverly Hills Hotel waiting for our car. Here's Sinatra had a limousine. And they were in front of the limousine. It had just been delivered. And they're getting into his limousine to go wherever the hell they were going to go. And they're laughing and scratching like nothing happened. Where are we going? What are we going to do? And they go off. We get in our car. I think I was driving. I take them back to their hotel. I go home. The next day, I go to work, and I'm at ABC. So I go to the studio, and my office was right next to the newsroom. And there was a window between my office and the newsroom. And I sit down, my phone rings. Hello? Frank Fiorino, please. Yes, this is he. Mr. Fiorino, this is Detective Harvey Blevins with the Beverly Hills Police. Yes? We understand you were witness to an incident at the Beverly Hills Hotel last evening involving Mr. Sinatra.
Yeah, I'm not remembering very well.
He said, well, Mr. Sinatra is sitting here with us, and his version of the incident is quite different from yours. Huh? Now, I'm dead. In my mind, it's over. And I'm thinking, how did they... And I look in the window to the newsroom next door, and there are two or three of the writers, and I think, And it's them.
Oh.
They thought that was the funniest joke.
That is actually a really good
one.
Oh,
yeah.
Scared the bejesus out of you.
Scared the bejesus out of me.
Frank Farino, thank you so much.
How amazing has this been?
No, I mean, just, you know, such a, I mean, you live so many different lives in one lifetime.
Oh, yeah. I was very, I mean, I know how fortunate I was. And again, I pointed out, this lady opened the door for me.
Rita Lakin.
Rita Lakin. Jeez.
Well, thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me to.
Well,
this,
you know.
This wasn't painful, was it?
Like I said, Frank and I have lunch from time to time, and I get to hear some of these stories, and I thought, you know, these stories need to be. So it's not just me telling them. Frank needs to tell these stories.
This is really good.
Bless you, bless you. Thank you, guys. I had a good time. I really enjoyed it.
A delight to have you. And a delight to have you too, Randy.
It was a delight to be a delight.
Was it a delight to be had? John McMullen, thank you very much, sir.
Another delight.
He lights up a room when he walks in.
Delight.
There you go. Thank you all for listening to this edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. We are grateful to Skip Page and the team at Little Bar for making us comfortable and keeping us well-fed and sauced, and also for the McCallum Theater for their sponsorship and all the great things that they do in our community. And we are most appreciative to you. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar, available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Patrick Evans.
Nice.
Meet your neighbors, fascinating and grand. Each conversation, a wave on the sand. Raise your glass and join the ride, where stories and dreams fully collide. At Big Conversations, Little Bar, brought to you by McCallum, our guiding star. And Randy, tales retold.